simply as heart failure. I sat down heavily in my chair, but I was too agitated to remain there for long, and in the end I called to Spider and went out again into the November afternoon that was already closing in to an early twilight, and began to walk, away from Mr. Daly's house and garden, past the barns and stables and sheds, and off across some stubble. I felt better for the exercise. Around me there was only the countryside, ploughed brown in ridges, with low hedges, and here and there two or three elm trees, their bare branches full of rooks' nests, from which those ugly black birds flew up in a raucous flapping flock every now and then, to reel about cawing in the leaden sky. There was a chill wind blowing over the fields, driving a spatter of hard rain before it. Spider seemed pleased to be out. As I walked, my thoughts were all concentrated upon the papers I'd just read, and the story they had told, and which was now becoming clear and complete. I had found out, more or less by chance, the solution, or much of it, to the identity of the woman in black, as well as the answer to many other questions. But although I now knew more, I was not satisfied by the discovery, only upset and alarmed, and afraid, too. I knew, and yet I did not know. I was bewildered, and nothing had truly been explained, for how can such things be? I have already stated that I had no more believed in ghosts than does any healthy young man of sound education, reasonable intelligence, and matter-of-fact inclinations. But ghosts I had seen. An event, and that a dreadful, tragic one of many years ago, which had taken place and been done with, was somehow taking place over and over again, repeating itself in some dimension other than the normal present one. A pony trap carrying a boy of six called Nathaniel, the adopted son of Mr. and Mrs. Drablow, and also his nursemaid, had somehow taken a wrong path in the sea mist and veered off the safety of the causeway and onto the marshes, where it had been sucked into the quicksands and swallowed up by the mud and rising waters of the estuary. The child and the nursemaid had been drowned, and so presumably had the pony, and whoever had been driving the trap. And now, out on those same marshes, the whole episode, or a ghost, a shadow, a memory of it, somehow happened again and again, how often I did not know. But nothing could be seen now, only heard. The only other things I knew were that the boy's mother, Janet Humphrey, had died of a wasting disease 12 years after her son, that they were both buried in the now disused and tumble-down graveyard beyond Eelmarsh House, that the child's nursery had been preserved in that house as he had left it, with his bed, his clothes, his toys, all undisturbed, and that his mother haunted the place. Moreover, that the intensity of her grief and distress, together with her pent-up hatred and desire for revenge, permeated the air all around. And it was that which so troubled me, the force of those emotions, for those were what I believed had power to harm. But to harm who? Was not everyone connected with that sad story now dead? For presumably Mrs. Drablow had been the very last of them. Eventually I began to be tired and turned back, but although I could not find any solution to the business, or perhaps because it was all so inexplicable, I could not put it from my mind. I worried at it all the way home, and brooded upon it as I sat in my quiet room, looking out into the evening's darkness. By the time the gong was sounded for dinner, I had worked myself up into such a fever of agitation that I determined to pour the whole story out to Mr. Samuel Daly, and to demand to hear anything whatever that he knew or had ever heard about the business. The scene was as before, the study of Mr. Daly's house after dinner, with the two of us in the comfortable wing chairs, the decanter and glasses between us on the small table. I was feeling considerably better after another good dinner. I had just come to the end of my story. Mr. Daly had sat listening without interruption, his face turned away from me, as I had relived, though with surprising calm, all the events of my short stay at Eelmarsh House, leading up to the time when he found me in a faint outside early that morning. And I had also told him of my conclusions, drawn from my perusal of the packet of letters, and the death certificates. He did not speak for some minutes. The clock ticked. The fire burned evenly and sweetly in the grate. The dog Spider lay in front of it on the hearth rug. Telling the story had been like a purgation, and now my head felt curiously light. My body in that limp state, such as follows upon a fever or a fright. But I reflected that I could, from this moment on, only get better, because I could only move step by steady step away from those awful happenings as surely as time went on.
"Well," he said at last, "you've come a long way since the night I met you on the late train."
It feels like 100 years ago. I feel like another man.
"You've gone through some rough seas."
"Well, I'm in the calm after the storm now, and there's an end of it." I saw that his face was troubled. "Come," I said bravely. "You don't think any more harm can come of it, surely? I never intend to go back there. Nothing would persuade me."
"No."
"Then all is well." He did not answer, but leaned forward and poured himself another small tot of whiskey. "Though I do wonder what will happen to the house," I said. "I'm sure no one local is ever going to want to live there, and I can't imagine anyone who might come from outside staying for long, once they get to know what the place is really like, and even if they manage not to hear any of the stories about it in advance. Besides, it's a rambling, inconvenient sort of spot. Whoever would want it?" Samuel Daly shook his head. "Do you suppose," I asked, after a few moments in which we sat in silence with our own thoughts, "that the poor old woman was haunted night and day by the ghost of her sister, and that she had to endure those dreadful noises out there?" For Mr. Daly had told me that the two had been sisters. "If such was the case, I wonder how she could have endured it without going out of her mind."
"Perhaps she did not."
"Perhaps." I was growing more and more sensible of the fact that he was holding something back from me, some explanation or information about Eel Marsh House and the Drabble family, and because I knew that, I would not rest or be quite easy in my mind until I'd found out everything there was to know. I decided to urge him strongly to tell it to me. Was there something I still did not see? If I had stayed there any longer, would I have encountered yet more horrors?
"That I cannot tell."
"But you could tell me something." He sighed and shifted about uneasily in his chair, avoiding my eye and looking into the fire, then stretching out his leg to rub at the dog's belly with the toe of his boot. "Come, we're a good way from the place, and my nerves are quite steady again. I must know. It can't hurt me now."
"Not you," he said. "No, not you, maybe."
"Oh, for God's sake, what is it you're holding back, man? What are you so afraid of telling me?"
"You, Arthur," he said, "will be away from here tomorrow, or the next day. You, if you're lucky, will neither hear nor see nor know of anything to do with that damned place again. The rest of us have to stay. We've to live with it."
"With what? Stories? Rumours? With the sight of that woman in black from time to time? With what?"
"With whatever will surely follow. Sometime or other. Crithin Gifford has lived with that for 50 years. It's changed people. They don't speak of it. You found that out. Those who've suffered worst say least. Jerome, Keckwick."
I felt my heartbeat increase. I put a hand to my collar to loosen it a little, drew my chair back from the fire. Now that the moment had come, I did not know, after all, whether I wanted to hear what Daly had to say.
"Janet Humphrey gave up her child, the boy, to her sister, Alice Drablow, and Alice's husband, because she'd no choice. At first she stayed away, hundreds of miles away, and the boy was brought up at Drablow, and was never intended to know his mother. But in the end, the pain of being parted from him, instead of easing, grew worse, and she returned to Crithin. She was not welcome at her parents' house, and the man, the child's father, had gone abroad for good. She got rooms in the town. She'd no money. She took in sewing. She acted as a companion to a lady. At first, apparently, Alice Drablow would not let her see the boy at all. But Janet was so distressed that she threatened violence, and in the end the sister relented just so far. Janet could visit very occasionally, but never see the boy alone, nor ever disclose who she was or that she had any relationship to him. No one ever foresaw that he'd turn out to look so like her, nor that the natural affinity between them would grow out. He became more and more attached to the woman who was, when all was said and done, his own mother, more and more fond. And as he did so, he began to be colder towards Alice Drablow. Janet planned to take him away, that much I do know. Before she could do so, the accident happened, just as you heard. The boy, the nursemaid, the pony trap, and its driver, Keckwick.
Keckwick?
Yes, his father. And there was the boy's little dog, too. That's a treacherous place, as you've found out to your own cost. The sea fret sweeps over the marshes suddenly. The quicksands are hidden.
So they all drowned.
And Janet watched. She was at the house, watching from an upper window, waiting for them to return.
I caught my breath, horrified.
The bodies were recovered, but they left the pony trap. It was held too fast by the mud. From that day, Janet Humphrey began to go mad.
Or was there any wonder?
No. Mad with grief and mad with anger and a desire for revenge. She blamed her sister who'd let them go out that day. There was no one's fault. The mist comes without warning.
Out of a clear sky.
Whether because of her loss and her madness or what, she also contracted a disease which caused her to begin to waste away. The flesh shrank from her bones, the colour was drained from her. She looked like a walking skeleton, a living spectre. When she went about the streets, people drew back. Children were terrified of her. She died, eventually. She died in hatred and misery. And as soon as ever she died, the hauntings began, and so they have gone on.
What, all the time, ever since?
No, now and again. Less these past few years. But still she is seen, and the sounds are heard by someone chancing to be out on the marsh.
And presumably by old Mrs. Drablow.
Who knows?
Well, Mrs. Drablow is dead. There, surely, the whole matter will rest.
But Mr. Daly had not finished. He was just coming to the climax of his story. And whenever she's been seen, he said in a low voice, in the graveyard, on the marsh, in the streets of the town, however briefly, and whoever by, there has been one sure and certain result.
Yes, I whispered.
In some violent or dreadful circumstance, a child has died.
What? What, you mean by accident?
Generally, in an accident. But once or twice it has been after an illness, which has struck them down within a day or a night or less.
You mean any child, a child of the town?
Any child. Jerome's child.
I had a sudden vision of that row of small, solemn faces, with hands all gripping the railings, that surrounded the schoolyard on the day of Mrs. Drablow's funeral. But surely, well, children sometimes do die.
They do.
And is there anything more than chance to connect these deaths with the appearance of that woman?
You may find it hard to believe. You may doubt it.
Well,
we know.
After a few moments, looking at his set and resolute face, I said quietly, I do not doubt, Mr. Daly. Then, for a very long time, neither of us said anything more. I knew that I had suffered a considerable shock that morning, after several days and nights of agitation and nervous tension consequent upon the hauntings of Eelmarsh House. but I did not altogether realize how deeply and badly the whole experience had affected me, both in mind and body. I went to bed that night, as I supposed for the last time under the Daly's roof. On the next morning I planned to catch the first available train back to London. When I told Mr. Daly of my decision, he did not argue with me. That night I slept wretchedly, waking every hour or so out of turbulent nightmares, my entire body in a sweat of anxiety. And when I did not sleep, I lay awake and tense in every limb, listening, remembering, and going over and over it all in my mind. I asked myself unanswerable questions about life and death and the borderlands between, and I prayed direct and simple, passionate prayers. I had been brought up, like most children, to a belief in the deity, brought up within the Christian Church. But although I still believed that its teachings were probably the best form of guidance on living a good life, I had found the deity rather remote, and my prayers were not anything but formal and dutiful. Not so now. Now I prayed fervently and with a newly awakened zeal. Now I realized that there were forces for good and those for evil doing battle together, and that a man might range himself on one side or the other. The morning was long in arriving, and when it did, it was again an overcast and wet one, dank, drear November. I got up, my head aching and my eyes burning, my legs heavy, and somehow managed to get dressed and drag myself downstairs to the breakfast table. But I could not face food, though I had an extreme thirst, and drank cup after cup of tea. Mr. and Mrs. Daly glanced at me anxiously now and again as I talked of my arrangements. I thought that I would not feel well again until I was sitting in the train, watching this countryside slide away out of sight, and I said as much, though at the time endeavouring to express my great gratitude to them both, because they had indeed been my saviours, of my life and of my sanity. Then I got up from the table and began to make my way to the dining room. But the door receded as I went. I seemed to be fighting towards it through a mist which was closing in upon me, so that I could not get my breath, and felt as if I was pushing against a heavy weight which I must remove before I could go any further. Samuel Daly caught me as I fell, and I was dimly aware that for the second time, though in very different circumstances, he was half carrying, half dragging me, this time up the stairs to my bedroom. There he helped me to undress. There he left me, my head throbbing and my mind confused. And there I remained, having frequent visits from an anxious-looking doctor, for 5 days. After that the worst of the fever and the delirium passed, leaving me exhausted and weak beyond belief. And I was able to sit up in an armchair, at first in my room and later downstairs. The Dalys were kindness and solicitude itself. The worst of it all was not the physical illness, the aching, the tiredness, the fever, but the mental turmoil I passed through. The woman in black seemed to haunt me even here, to sit on the end of my bed, to push her face suddenly down close to mine as I lay asleep, so I awoke, crying out in terror. And my head rang with the sound of the child crying out on the marsh, and of the rocking chair, and the drowning whinny of the pony. I could not break free of any of them, and when I was not having feverish delusions and nightmares, I was remembering every word of the letters and death certificates, as if I could see the pages held up before my mind's eye. But at last I began to be better. The fears died down, the visions faded, and I found myself again. I was exhausted, drained, but well. There was nothing else the woman could do to me, surely. I had endured and survived. After 12 days I was feeling almost completely recovered. It was a day of winter sunshine, but there had been one of the first frosts of the year. I was sitting at the open French windows of the drawing-room, a rug over my knees, looking at the bare bushes and trees, silvery white and stiff with rime, stark against the sky. It was after lunch. I might sleep a little or not, but in any case no one would disturb me. Spider lay contentedly at my feet, as she had done throughout the days and nights of my illness. I had grown more fond of the little dog than I would ever have imagined possible. feeling that we shared a bond, because we'd been through our time of trial together. A robin was perched on one of the stone urns at the top of the balustrade, head up, eyes bead bright, and I watched him happily, while he hopped a foot or two and then paused again to listen and to sing. I reflected that before coming here, I would never have been able to concentrate on such an ordinary thing so completely, but would have been restless to be up and off, doing this or that busily. Now I appreciated the bird's presence, enjoyed simply watching his movements for as long as he chose to remain outside my window, with an intensity I had never before experienced. I heard some sounds outside, the engine of a motor car, voices round at the front of the house, but paid them little attention, so wrapped up was I in my observation of the bird. Besides, they would have nothing to do with me. There were footsteps along the corridor, and then they stopped outside the door of the drawing-room, and then, after a hesitation, it opened. Or perhaps it was later than I thought, and someone had come to see how I was and whether I wanted a cup of tea. "Arthur?" I turned, startled, and then jumped from my chair in amazement, disbelief, and delight. Stella, my own dear Stella, was coming towards me across the room.
Chapter 12. The Woman in Black. The following morning I left the house. We were taken in Mr. Samuel Daly's motor directly to the railway station. I had settled my account at the Gifford Arms by messenger, and I did not go into the town of Griffin Gifford again. It seemed altogether wise to take medical advice, for the doctor had been particularly anxious that I should not do anything or go anywhere to upset my still delicately balanced equilibrium. And in truth I did not want to see the town, or to risk meeting Mr. Jerome or Keckwick, or most of all to catch so much as a glimpse of the distant marsh. All that was behind me. It might have happened, I thought, to another person. The doctor had told me to put the whole thing from my mind, and I resolved to try and do so. With Stella beside me, I did not see how I could fail. The only regret I had at leaving the place was a genuine sadness at parting company with Mr. and Mrs. Samuel Daly, and when we shook hands, I made him promise that he would visit us when he next came to London, which he did, he said, once or at most twice a year. Moreover, a puppy was booked for us, as soon as Spider should produce any. I was going to miss the little dog a great deal. But there was one last question I had to ask, though I found it hard to bring the matter up. "I must know," I burst out at last, while Stella was safely out of earshot and deep in conversation with Mrs. Daly, whom she'd been able to draw out with her own natural friendliness and warmth. Samuel Daly looked at me sharply. "You told me that night..." I took a deep breath to try and calm myself. A child in Crithin Gifford has always died."
"Yes."
I could not go on, but my expression was enough, I knew. My desperate anxiety to be told the truth was evident.
"Nothing," Daly said quickly. "Nothing has happened."
I was sure he had been going to add "yet," but he stopped, and so I added it for him. But he only shook his head silently. "Oh, pray God it may not, that the chain is broken, that her power is at an end, that she's gone, and I was the last ever to see her." He put a hand reassuringly on my arm.
"Yes. Yes."
I wanted above all for it to be so. For the time that had elapsed since I'd last seen the woman in black, the ghost of Jennet Humphrey, to be long enough now, for it to be proof positive that the curse had quite gone. She had been a poor, crazed, troubled woman, dead of grief and distress, filled with hatred and desire for revenge. Her bitterness was understandable. The wickedness that led her to take away other women's children because she had lost her own, understandable too, but not forgivable. There was nothing anyone could do to help her, except, perhaps, pray for her soul, I thought. Mrs. Drablow, the sister she blamed for the death of her child, was dead herself and in her grave, and now that the house was empty at last,
Perhaps the hauntings and their terrible consequences for the innocent would cease for ever. The car was waiting in the drive. I shook hands with the Dalys, and, taking Stella's arm and keeping tightly hold of it, climbed in and leaned back against the seat. With a sigh, indeed almost a sob of relief, I was driven away from Cryffyn Gifford. My story is almost done. There is only the last thing left to tell. And that I can scarcely bring myself to write about. I have sat here at my desk, day after day, night after night, a blank sheet of paper before me, unable to lift my pen, trembling and weeping too. I have gone out and walked in the old orchard, and further across the country beyond Monk's Peace, for mile after mile, but seen nothing of my surroundings, noticing neither animal nor bird, unable to tell even the state of the weather, so that several times I've come home soaked through to the skin, to Esme's considerable distress. And that has been another cause of anguish. She has watched me and wondered and been too sensitive to ask questions. I have seen the worry and distress on her face and sensed her restlessness as we have sat together in the late evenings. I have been quite unable to tell her anything at all. She has no idea what I have been going through or why. She will have no idea until she reads this manuscript, and at that time I shall be dead and beyond her. But now at last I have summoned up sufficient courage. I will use the very last of my strength that has been so depleted by the reliving of those past horrors to write the end of the story. Stella and I returned to London, and within 6 weeks we had married. Our original plan had been to wait at least until the following spring, but my experiences had changed me greatly, so that I now had an urgent sense of time, a certainty that we should not delay but seize upon any joy and good fortune, any opportunity, at once, and hold fast to it. Why should we wait? What was there beyond the mundane considerations of money, property, and possessions to keep us from marrying? Nothing. And so we married, quietly and without fuss, and lived in my old rooms, with another room added, which the landlady had been more than willing to rent to us, until such time as we could afford a small house of our own. We were as happy as a young man and his bride may possibly be, content in each other's company, not rich, but not poor either, busy and looking forward to the future. Mr. Bentley gave me a little more responsibility, and a consequent increase in salary as time went on. About Eel Marsh House and the Drablow estate and papers, I had expressly begged him that I be told nothing, and so I was not. The names were never mentioned to me again. A little over a year after our marriage, Stella gave birth to our child, a son, whom we called Joseph Arthur Samuel, and Mr. Samuel Daly was his godfather, for he was our sole remaining tie with that place, that time. But although we saw him occasionally in London, he never once spoke of the past. Indeed, I was so filled with joy and contentment in my life that I never so much as thought of those things, and the nightmares quite ceased to trouble me. I was in a particularly peaceful, happy frame of mind one Sunday afternoon in the summer of the year following our son's birth. I could not have been less prepared for what was to come. We had gone to a large park, 10 miles or so outside London, which formed the grounds of a noble house, and in the summer season stood open to the general public at weekends. There was a festive, holiday air about the place, a lake on which small boats were being rowed, a bandstand with a band playing jolly tunes, stalls selling ices and fruit. Families strolled in the sunshine, children tumbled about upon the grass. Stella and I walked happily, with young Joseph taking a few unsteady steps, holding on to our hands while we watched him, as proud as any parents could be. Then Stella noticed that one of the attractions upon offer was a donkey, and a pony and trap, on both of which rides could be taken, down an avenue of great horse chestnut trees, and, thinking that the boy would find such a treat to his liking, we led him to the docile grey donkey, and I endeavoured to lift him up into the saddle. But he shrieked and pulled away at once and clung to me, while at the same time pointing to the pony trap and gesturing excitedly. So, because there was only room for two passengers, Stella took Joseph, and I stood, watching them bowl merrily away down the ride, between the handsome old trees which were in full glorious leaf. For a while they went out of sight, away round a bend, and I began to look idly about me, at the other enjoyers of the afternoon. Then, quite suddenly, I saw her. She was standing away from any of the people close up to the trunk of one of the trees. I looked directly at her, and she at me. There was no mistake. My eyes were not deceiving me. It was she, the woman in black with a wasted face, the ghost of Janet Humphrey. For a second, I simply stared in incredulity and astonishment. Then in cold fear. I was paralyzed, rooted to the spot on which I stood, and all the world went dark around me, and the shouts and happy cries of all the children faded. I was quite unable to take my eyes away from her. There was no expression on her face, and yet I felt all over again the renewed power emanating from her, the malevolence and hatred and passionate bitterness. It pierced me through. At the same moment, to my intense relief, the pony cart came trotting back down the avenue, through the shaft of sunlight that lay across the grass, with my dear Stella sitting in it and holding up the baby, who was bouncing and calling and waving his little arms with delight. They were almost back. They had almost reached me. I would retrieve them, and then we would go, for I didn't want to stay here for a second longer. I made ready. They'd almost come to a halt when they passed the tree beside which the woman in black was still standing. And as they did so, she moved quickly, her skirts rustling as if to step into the pony's path. The animal swerved violently, then reared a little, its eyes filled with sudden fright. And then it took off and went careering away through the glade between the trees, whinnying and quite out of control. There was a moment of dreadful confusion with several people starting off after it, and women and children shrieking. I began to run crazily, and then I heard it. The sickening crack and thud as the pony and its cart collided with one of the huge tree trunks. And then silence. A terrible silence which can only have lasted for seconds and seemed to last for years. As I raced towards where it had fallen, I glanced back over my shoulder. The woman had disappeared. They lifted Stella gently from the cart. Her body was broken, her neck and legs fractured, though she was still conscious. The pony had only stunned itself, but the cart was overturned and its harness tangled, so that it could not move, but lay on the ground whinnying and snorting in fright. Our baby son had been thrown clear against another tree. He lay crumpled on the grass below it, dead. This time there was no merciful loss of consciousness. I was forced to live through it all, every minute, and then every day thereafter for 10 long months, until Stella, too, died from her terrible injuries. I had seen the ghost of Janet Humphrey, and she had had her revenge. They asked for my story. I have told it. Enough.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.